Today we are going to talk about sex, intimacy and robots. I'm Bojana Romić, media researcher at Malmö University, and my guest today is Jeffrey Barzel, professor of informatics at Indiana University, whose research includes studies on maker communities, online creative communities, and intimate and sexual interaction. Jeffrey, welcome to Medea Box.
Thank you very much.
We'll start off this episode with a discussion of so-called real dolls, which you argue can help us understand how to design for intimacy, sexuality, and self-care. But before getting into the design matters, we would appreciate your explanation or your take on the real doll, what the real doll actually is.
Yeah, so a real doll is a very realistic sex doll, basically. They are they're fully human-sized. They're made of high-quality silicone, and they have skeletons and structure. And they're quite heavy, and they cost a lot of money. So they're investments that people make, and they're just hyper-realistic sex dolls, basically.
And those that are interested in them, purchasing them, they can decide upon their appearance.
Yes. Yes, there's a customization. I haven't looked at it in a couple of years, so I'm referring to what I saw in probably 2018 or 2017. But at least at the time, you could make decisions about height, basic body shape, hair color, eye color, racial characteristics, and that sort of thing. And I don't know. I would guess there's probably a few hundred possible variations that you could choose from.
Real dolls typically have a body of a woman or a younger woman, I understood. Although there are some dolls that could have a male appearance, although I understood that they're not very popular or common.
That's right. I think this is primarily targeted towards heterosexual men. And most of the women fit stereotypes of a feminine beauty from the eyes of heterosexual men.
So can we comment on their appearance and how their looks communicate with some other cultural understandings of what an attractive female is?
Yeah, and that's why I try to use the word stereotypical in there, yeah. Because I do think that they're very stereotypical in the sense that I think if you pulled up sort of the default figure, if you go to the website and look at the ones that they choose to showcase on the website, you're looking at very young women. I think a lot of them are very tall, large breasts, very curvy. So kind of the standard stereotypes you'd expect to see in Playboy or pornographic images. I think those are the most common types of images that you would see and expect to see by default at the website. Now, when we look at our data, we saw some different things, but that's how it seems to be marketed, and that seems to be what's driving it.
There is some research done on sex robots, and we kind of indicated in our introduction that we are going to discuss that as well. Mm-hmm. And also in your articles of dolls and men anticipating sexual intimacy with robots, you draw a parallel between real dolls and robots. How do you see that connection between real dolls and current or future sex robots?
Right. I think that's a really good question. And we're clear in the paper. It's a very speculative relationship because we don't know. I don't think anybody knows. But one of the points that we made in the paper is that a lot of the sex robots that exist today, or at least at the time we were writing it, reflected a fairly narrow imagination of what that space might actually be. And so one of the things we were trying to do was to not focus overly on the robots themselves, but to try to get more into the subjective experiences of people who engage with those kinds of products or any kind of anthropomorphic sexual, I don't know the word either. Is it sex aid? Is it sex toy? Sex companion? It's actually hard to even define the right language to describe some of these things. So I think where we see the parallel is not necessarily from doll to robot, but rather from the subjective experience of having an intimate or sexual relationship with an anthropomorphic being, where realism, some type of realism, some dimension of realism is very important. In the case of real dolls, they look pretty human as much as they're able to do in the context. I mean, there's an uncanny valley for sure.
When you see a photograph, some of them, you basically cannot even say that it's a doll.
But yeah.
there are examples of users who tried to kind of appropriate their functionality or improve their functionality. You give the example of a person who tried to move the eyes of his
yes.
Doll yes. just to create more kind of a natural mm-hmm. communication, as it were.
Yeah.
An interesting phenomenon that you describe in your paper is that of imagined or even real companionship, mm-hmm. how people interact with their dolls, how their coexistence
yes.
even functions, their kind of mundane activities that are created. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. I think one of the focal points of the paper, I mean, it's fairly obvious when you look at them, you're probably going to be troubled right away by the way they objectify women. And that's a very serious issue, and in no way do I dismiss it. But I think one of the focal points of the paper was subjectification, the ways in which the people who have these dolls imbue subjectivity on the dolls, and the way that they also construct a subjectivity for themselves and in that relationship. So I think one of the things we're really interested in is the ways that people become subjects and the dolls become subjects, and the relationship is one between a putative subject or a constructed subject in the doll, and then another constructed subject, which is the owner who has taken on a certain subjectivity in order to relate to the doll. And some of that work, and it is work, granted it was troubling in diverse ways, but it was a lot of work. It was very creative, and it's clearly very important and meaningful to those individuals. And so without denying the problematic dimensions of this, we still wanted to have some empathy and try to understand the needs that are being met.
You mentioned the issue of objectivization. Mm. I would just like to, for those who are maybe not that familiar with the theme, the argument typically goes that the dolls or even robots are in a way normalizing violent acts, which if it was a real person, it would be a sexual assault. So there is this concern that these dolls are normalizing these acts and that it could be a venting mechanism for social misfits.
Right. Well, I think it's really important. And I think it's even though it's not the focus of our argument, it actually comes up many times. There's a couple different ways to look at it. One is that, yes, the dolls do lend themselves to literal sexual violence in the sense that one can do anything to them. But I think there's another version which is equally troubling and maybe a little more subtle, which is that the dolls are incapable of giving consent. So since they're incapable of giving consent, consent is not relevant to the kinds of sexual encounters that people have. And so that is dehumanizing. And because it is a gendered relationship as well, and because only the man has consent, it does actually normalize a very regressive structure, and in that sense is very troubling. But at the same time, you know, like I was saying earlier, I think this kind of mutual subjectification also shows that the issues of objectification are always a little bit complicated, and that a lot of times what is happening is that people are crafting relationships that maybe in some sense is extreme, but maybe in another sense is not extreme. So, you know, if you've ever loved a stuffed animal, you know, probably it wasn't a sexual relationship, but still it was a very powerful bond that you had with that inanimate object, and you imbued subjectivity on it. And you put yourself in a position of care. Those kinds of things we think are quite normal or socially acceptable. So it's complicated when it moves into a space of sex where, on the one hand, yeah, literally, you know, one could rape or physically attack one of these dolls without any sort of consequence, or, you know, more subtly, just do whatever you want without the issue of consent on your own terms in a one-way basis. So I guess what I'm saying is that I think this issue is super complicated with these, and I think it's actually best not to try to force it into a sort of a moral space where it's like, yes, this is acceptable because, or no, this is intrinsically violent because...
Yeah, like any other technology, it can be used in both good and bad ways. And there was an example of sex dolls made in Japan who are essentially children. So there are these kind of borderline cases that showed some kind of pathological side of society. But I would like to mention two concerns that are an opposing argument to these technologies, both dolls and also sex robots. And that would be a concern that it resembles slavery. That's the first one. The second one would be that it actually resembles prostitution. So would you like to say a few words about
that? Sure. You use the word pathology. And I think it's very easy to pathologize or to kind of go there. And I mean, I'm not immune to that reaction. I mean, I see real dolls and my first reaction was like, whoa, that's strange. If I'm honest, I even felt a little bit judgmental to the kind of people who buy them. But there has been research on people who buy them, and they're not perverts, they're not weirdos, they're not social misfits. For the most part, they are relatively representative of the population, of the male population in certain respects. So I think one important thing that we want to call out is that these are not people who are damaged in some sort of medical sense or something like that. And so when we study them, we're not studying a pathologized population. And so in some ways, the kinds of interest and considerations they have probably do reflect things that a lot of people feel, even if a lot of those same people wouldn't choose to get these dolls. Now, with regard to how that then fits in with human relationships with technology, I have an Amazon Alexa at home, and that device is every bit, it's also gendered, and it's also a kind of a slave. There's no sexual relationship between me and my Amazon, but I have no doubt that millions of sexual utterances have been directed at Amazon Alexa. I don't think Amazon's released that data, but I can't imagine that people haven't, you know, made those kinds of things. So I think one thing we do need to figure out as a society, as technologists, as designers, as studies of people who study culture, is actually to figure out the human-technology relationship as technology moves away from being a tool, an instrument of the will, towards being something more autonomous, having its own agency, having its own understanding. And I think in some ways that people's relationships with dolls anticipates, I'm not saying it predicts, but it gives you maybe a fractured vision of or a broken glimpse or images of how that relationship might be, and also the ways that's troubling and some issues that we should think about ethically. And I think, you know, your comments on prostitution, I mean, I think as societies have become, I think the arguments for and against prostitution have really shown how morally complicated that phenomenon is. And I think that the same case is it is for real dolls. I don't want to judge it, and I don't want to not judge it, because I mean I see it, I am troubled by certain things, I won't dispute it, but I also see an awful lot of normality as well in that, of just everyday human existence. And I can see things that I myself do in my relationships with technology or my relationships with inanimate objects or that kind of thing. If you've ever moved house and there's precious objects that you can't part with. I mean, I think that these relationships surface quite a bit. That's very pertinent to the discussion of robots and sex robots, even if they're not predictive in a literal sense of behaviors or what will become commonplace or anything like that. I think that this surfaces a lot.
And I think that this tendency to anthropocize, mm-hmm. essentially objects, is a very interesting phenomenon. We can look at it from, for example, legal perspective. How does one qualify as an electronic person? There has been some discussion about that. Mm. Because at this moment, an electronic person in legal terms means a company, really. So... But I read some papers about, or even there was even a session at EU Parliament about how to think of some alternative personalities, even electronic personalities, mm-hmm. when the time comes. Some speculative projects are ongoing, and I do think that people should discuss that. They should try to anticipate, imagine, but not go overboard with those limiting labels that can, in some cases, do more harm than good.
I think that's exactly right. I think that we have a set of categories, ontological categories, that are sort of breaking down right now. And of course, we know that Amazon Alexa and the equivalent from Google and Samsung, that they've also worked with actors and writers to try to give them personality. And of course, we also know that thanks to design thinking and things like that, people can constantly change and iterate and experiment. And so I've noticed even in the last month or so that my Amazon Alexa has changed its behavior a little bit. So that if I say, what's the weather, and then the Alexa answers, it then after that says something like, have a nice day, or would you like to ask me about something else? So now it suddenly is following up or concluding the conversation in a way that it didn't do that before. And I don't have any inside knowledge about why that's the case, but there has been a change. And so we know that the people who are designing these interactions are very much looking at what kinds of experiences they're creating and trying to make them better, whatever that means.
I've seen one example of that, or I interacted with one of those pieces of software, essentially. Mm-hmm. So you have a software that is ordering a table, the restaurant, for, say, 6 people. But they made it make these irregular breaks in a sentence. It seems that it's hesitant a
yes.
little bit, and all of a sudden, it actually is a lot more convincing.
Yes.
It has nothing to do with so-called intelligence.
Right.
It has to do with the way people normally speak.
Yes.
So
I've got a great example of that. I've started to get some spam calls. So I'm from the U.S. Of course, I still have student loans, like everybody who graduates from university in the U.S. And I've now been getting calls lately. It says, hi, this is Karen. I'm just calling you. I just wanted to follow up on your student loans. And I was wondering if you might be available. So she says several times. She interrupts, breaks her. It's in a machine voice. I mean, it doesn't sound... You have to listen, but it almost doesn't sound like a machine voice because it interrupts itself and it says and has a very human intonation. And so I think they are getting exactly what you're saying. I think they're learning how to talk to humans in a way that we can relate to and find authentic.
Yes. So the actual little problem is that people tend to form attachments to both pieces
yes.
of software, things in very general terms. It can be software, it can be... Aibo robot, it can be sex doll, it can be you
mm-hmm,
name
mm-hmm.
it.
Yep.
But it is quite interesting how quickly people tend to anthropomorphize things and maybe even project that they're more intelligent than they really are.
Yes, I totally agree. And I talked to somebody who's in game design, and we're talking about AI and game design. One of the things there is that the actions of video game characters are so limited that you can invest a lot of AI resources into making those limited things very good. So if it's a first-person shooter, they can shoot and they can hide. And they can squat, or they can stand, or they can climb. But there's actually a very limited repertoire of behaviors. But because the world of the game, everything is so limited that when the opposing machine-controlled characters are very good, it's easy to forget that they're not good at everything else too, that they can't also write poetry or, solve a problem, or that they don't have like broken printers at home that won't connect to the network or something like this. I think you're right about that.
I think we can slowly wrap up. We're very happy to have you here at
Malmö
University. And I will use this opportunity to announce a conference. This is the very first announcement of the conference I'm organizing together with Professor Bo Reimer in November this year. It's called Artificial Creativity. We are going to have discussion about robots who create artifacts. So thank you very much, and thanks everyone for listening.
Thank you. And before we turn everything off, I'd also like to acknowledge my co-authors on this, Norman Makoto Su, Amanda Lazar, and Shawan Barzell, who were great collaborators on this project.
Thank you very much.